because Africa Today is coming.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
As the U.S. closes door, China is opening new ones and redefining Africa's place in the world. There is talk of the continent turning Trump's punitive tariffs into a new opportunity. Now, will Africa rise to reshape its destiny, or will it be left behind in the global power struggle? And joining us today to discuss this important topic is Irete Bakara Yusuf. Now, she is a broadcast journalist and founder of African Journalists Against Genocide. Also with us today is Zizwe Chiguka. Now, he is the organizer for the All African People's Revolutionary Party and the African Party for the Independence of Guinea and Cape Verde. Join us for this week's edition of Africa Today as we discuss how African countries can turn Trump's punitive tariffs into an opportunity. When the United States raised tariffs on African exports to as high as 30% in the case of South Africa, shockwaves rippled across the continent. Overnight, billions in trade were at risk. Uganda, Gabon, and Niger had already lost their duty-free access under a U.S. program known as the African Growth and Opportunity Act. For many, it felt like punishment, but for Africa, it could be a wake-up call. Because while Washington is shutting doors, Beijing is opening them. By 2024, Africa-China trade had surged past $295 billion. In just the first 5 months of 2025, it added another $134 billion. Factories, ports, and railways financed by China are changing the way Africa connects with the world. At the same time, African nations are rethinking their own future. The African Continental Free Trade Area is laying the foundations for the world's largest single market. Across the continent, a new spirit of self-reliance is taking hold. Now, these tariffs aren't just about economics. They are moves in a global power struggle over currency, over alliances, over the future of trade itself. Now, the question is, will Africa turn exclusion into power and claim its place in the new multipolar world order?
Trump's tariffs, Africa's opportunity.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa recently addressed a virtual BRICS leaders' extraordinary summit that focused on the current economic environment and the state of the multilateral system. Now, commenting on the tariffs war imposed by the U.S., he said that we are witnessing seismic shifts in global trade that present both challenges and opportunities. Let's take a listen.
We are witnessing seismic shifts in global trade that present both challenges as well as opportunities in the reordering of the global economy. There is a shift from a unipolar to a multipolar world. This moment is marked by intensifying global competition and growing geopolitical tensions. Unilateral tariff actions are contributing to an increasingly protectionist environment, which poses great hardships and danger for the countries of the Global South. The uncertainty of the new trading regime has already negatively affected employment levels in my own country, South Africa, and is an obstacle to our economic growth. We are therefore supportive of meaningful BRICS initiatives that improve the resilience of our economies as BRICS countries.
Well, the South African president, they are speaking of new opportunities for Africa amid the trade war imposed by the U.S. president on Africa. Now, let's start off with Irete Bakara Yusuf. Given the recent discussions surrounding the tariffs imposed on African exports by the U.S., do you believe Africa should view these as an opportunity to reduce its reliance on Western markets?
I think it's important that Africa begins to actually take control and steer and sort of pull away more and more from its dependency on Western markets. Why is that? Because Africa needs to realize the only way that Africa can grow is to continue or begin to do more and more business with the within themselves, within Africa, across the region, and, you know, pull away from the powers that the Western region had over Africa. Indeed, the only way we can actually begin to see a growth, and if you like, a Viva Africa, and a fully independent Africa, an Africa that works for Africans, and indeed her massive youth, is to actually continue to do business.
Thank you. Now, let's bring in Zizwe Chiguka. Do you think Africa's ongoing efforts to reduce reliance on the U.S. through initiatives like the African Continental Free Trade Area will help shield the continent from the impacts of a U.S. trade war?
The Africa Free Trade Agreement will definitely help to buffer the African nation states against the tariff policies of the current U.S. administration, basically because Africa is the richest continent on Earth, and the economies of Africa, they need to be integrated so that they're not so dependent on foreign direct investment or foreign markets. Many of the nation states in Africa are dependent upon U.S. foreign market for sales. But if we integrate the economies of Africa, and the African Free Trade Agreement is a step in that direction, we will become less dependent upon the U.S. economy as a foreign market.
President Donald Trump's aggressive tariff policies, particularly the imposition of reciprocal tariffs of up to 50% on imports from countries with trade surpluses with the U.S., have significantly disrupted global trade dynamics. African nations heavily reliant on U.S. markets for exports like textiles, agriculture, and minerals have been among the most affected. In response, many are actively seeking new markets across Asia to mitigate the adverse economic impacts.
President Trump's recent decision to exempt key African minerals like gold, tungsten, uranium, and graphite from U.S. tariffs has raised questions about the underlying motives of these trade policies. Now, the administration justifies these exemptions as necessary to secure critical supply chains vital for sectors like aerospace, electronics, and energy. Now, Mr. Chiguka, how do you interpret this move?
The Trump administration could not put tariffs on those rare earth minerals because of the need for those rare earth minerals. It's the same thing in Africa. There are certain things, mineral resources, like uranium, coltan, etc. The administration in the U.S. cannot afford to put tariffs on those kinds of things because of the need. So they take people as fools, basically, when they have these economic arrangements and negotiations with other countries. And it's also a result of colonialism in the past in Africa, that the U.S. government is able to bully people in Africa, the governments in Africa, in terms of making these arrangements to the detriment of the economy of the African nation states. So unification is the key. The integration of the African economy will stop all of those problems that the colonialists and imperialists are trying to impose on the African nation states.
Thanks for that, Mr. Chiguka. Let's now take a short break before we continue our discussion on punitive U.S. tariffs on Africa and how they can be turned into an opportunity for the continent. Stay with us.
Trump's tariffs, Africa's opportunity.
The African Continental Free Trade Area stands as a cornerstone of Africa's development vision under Agenda 2063. Now, a unified market holds immense potential, unlocking boundless opportunities for the continent's growth and prosperity. The Secretary General of this Pan-African body elaborates on the opportunities.
By the year 2035, the AfCFTA market, the combined GDP of the AfCFTA market is estimated to be close to $7 trillion United States dollars. That means that there are opportunities for small medium enterprises, for young entrepreneurs to export across regions of the African continent and to take advantage of this vast market. However, if we don't have an integrated single market, we will not be able to achieve the positive projections that many around the world have made about the potential of the AfCFTA.
Well, as Africa continues to develop its economic strategies, initiatives like the African Continental Free Trade Area are undermining the U.S. Multilateral trade frameworks with Africa, such as the so-called African Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA. This is seen by many as presenting an opportunity for Africa to push for stronger economic integration within the continent itself. Ms. Bakare Yusuf, what are your thoughts on this?
Absolutely, it does. I mean, AGOA really, yes, Nigeria, my country, was one of the largest users, if not the largest users of AGOA, but, you know, that no longer exists. And again, AGOA was just a way of, you know, it was the American soft power way of controlling African countries. So certainly we should get away. And I can't say, I mean, I can honestly say for myself, I am one of those who sees this as a great, great opportunity for Africa to free itself of the American stronghold. But the question is Africa ready? They need our resources. The same President Trump that's imposing tariffs on South Africa, on Nigeria, etc., that's weaponizing tariffs, is actually, they need the rare earth. He's talking about, oh, I'm stopping the war in Congo, you know, in exchange for natural resources. Well, he hasn't even stopped any war, but I have no doubt he's probably signed the natural resource on how to steal from Congo, how to steal from Sudan, how to steal from Nigeria. Heck, how to steal from as many parts of Africa as possible. And those are the things that we need to stop from happening. If African countries had led the initiative and ensured that the war in Congo, the genocide going on, is actually stopped and they're able to get there and stop it, talk to their brother leaders, put a stop to it, then we wouldn't have had a President Trump who would be able to interlude and claim that he stopped a war, which he hasn't stopped. I must keep saying that. He hasn't stopped. What he did was to sign a contract to collect more minerals, to steal, not collect, to actually thieve and steal more minerals from Africa in the future, in order to tell to do a ceasefire that only lasted a few days.
The exclusion of African countries from AGOA presents a significant new opportunity for the continent to reconsider and potentially break free from trade agreements that may have restricted its long-term growth and potential. Now, Mr. Chiguka, how has AGOA's narrow focus on specific industries and reliance on external partners hindered the continent's ability to diversify its economies and pursue more self-sustaining models of development?
Definitely think that this is an opportunity for Africa to unify economically, politically, socially. On the economic front, the African Growth and Opportunities Act was a thing that was used by the imperialist powers to keep a dependency relationship of these newly independent African states. So this would work in our favor to spark a change in Africa to further integrate the African economy. And so the U.S. administration is helping to mobilize our people for greater forms, levels of unity on the economic front. So it's a good thing. It's a good thing that they are actually trying to impose these tariffs. So now we can integrate our economies and be less dependent on the African Growth and Opportunities Act, which is to the disfavor of the African nation states anyway.
China's expanding influence in Africa represents a significant shift from the historically exploitative engagement of Western powers, particularly the United States. Many analysts view the increasing trade between China and African nations as a constructive alternative to the punitive tariffs often associated with U.S. economic policy.
There's a China-Africa summit every year in which the Chinese forgive the debt of many African nation states. And also China has helped to build infrastructure projects throughout Africa, such as the Trans-Am Railroad back in the 70s. So that relationship with China has always been a positive and is increasingly becoming even better with their help financially and economically, so that we are less dependent upon the U.S. and the European imperialists that charge astronomical interest rates on these loans that they give us. Because if you look at all the nation states in Africa that have taken out International Monetary Fund loans, they're still paying the interest and they can't even get to the principal. So therefore, the indebtedness of African nation states to IMF is continuing to rise, whereas China is helping and forgives many of the loans so that we can become less dependent on the International Monetary Fund in Africa.
In response to the U.S.'s aggressive trade policy, there is a growing argument for African countries to focus on de-dollarization and create more independent trade structures within the global south. Now, Mr. Chibuka, how can de-dollarization and the establishment of independent trade structures help African countries mitigate the impact of external economic pressures such as an aggressive trade policy from the U.S.
Therefore, it is incumbent upon Africa to take this opportunity to break away from the U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar was the reserve currency and is steadily declining in terms of nation states that are dependent on the U.S. dollar. So this is an opportunity for Africa to become less dependent and use the mechanism of de-dollarization through the BRICS Alliance and other mechanisms, so that when the U.S. dollar declines, finally, it won't affect Africa as much. It won't be as disruptive, because the handwriting is on the wall for the U.S. dollar. It is declining on a global scale, and the African nations have to be able to adjust, or they will go down if they keep dependency on the U.S. dollar. Therefore, de-dollarization is a must in Africa.
South Africa has been hit hard by the Trump tariffs. The ANC-led coalition government has struggled to respond effectively, while some critics argue that South Africa's response lacked urgency or forcefulness, especially given the economic stakes. Pretoria has clearly taken diplomatic and strategic steps.
Ms. Bakare Yusuf will have the last word today. Now, what steps should African governments take to ensure that they are better prepared for such economic shocks in future?
We wait, like I said earlier, we wait on the until the problem lands in our country, slaps us in the face before we start to respond. Why isn't there anybody looking to the future and planning? That is what African countries must do. African leaders must start to look, visionize a really strong and independent Africa and continue to plan, not just plan, implement, not just implement, create the structure, the framework, the foundation to build that vision on. But you can't do that again if you don't invest in your education. So now we come to social structure. You've got to invest in your education because you have to be ready to pass on the baton to the next generation. Yet again, we've got the likes of Paul Biya, who are wanting to run again and again and again. So the youth, of course, they feel despondent. They're in despair. They don't see a future.
Well, there you have it. Africa needs to have visionary leaders and invest in education for the continent to be free of manipulation by the likes of Trump. I'd like to thank our guests today, Ireti Bakare Yusuf and Zizwe Chibuka, for their incisive analysis. And now let's proceed to the next part of our program, honoring Africa's remarkable civilizations, which are the cornerstone of its vibrant cultural legacy. In today's fast-evolving world, it's increasingly important for young Africans to reconnect with their heritage. Now, preserving this identity is key to shaping a confident and empowered future. My colleague, Jana Tali, will share more on this.
Hello, I'm Janet Ali, and welcome to a series of programs that will delve into some of the ancient African civilizations. As Africa moves to become a focal point of the world's economy, reflecting on the continent's rich civilization is critical to preserve its pure identity. Today, let us get to know more about the Songhai civilization. Songhai Empire, one of the largest and most powerful civilizations in West African history. This civilization emerged in the 15th century and was centered around the Niger River. The empire's capital was the city of Gao, but it's also included other significant cities like Timbuktu and Djenne. The rise of the Songhai Empire began under the leadership of Sunni Ali in the 1460s. Sunni Ali expanded the empire's territories through military conquests and established control over crucial trade routes. His successor, Askia Muhammad, further centralized the administration, promoting Islam and implementing a legal system based on Islamic law. Under Askia Muhammad's rule, the empire experienced a golden age marked by political stability, economic prosperity, and cultural flourishing. The Songhai Empire's achievements were numerous. Timbuktu and Djenne became renowned centers of learning, attracting scholars and students from across the Islamic world. The empire's wealth was built on trans-Saharan trade, dealing in gold, salt, and other valuable commodities. The Songhai military was also formidable, utilizing cavalry and riverine forces to maintain control over their vast territories. However, the decline of the Songhai Empire began in the late 16th century. Internal strife and succession disputes weakened the central authority. In 1591, the Moroccan army invaded the Songhai Empire equipped with firearms, which gave them a significant advantage over the Songhai forces. The Battle of Tondibi marked the end of Songhai dominance, and the empire gradually fragmented into smaller states. Despite its decline, the legacy of Songhai civilization still endures. Efforts to preserve the heritage of the Songhai include protecting historical sites like the Sankore Madrasa in Timbuktu, a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Timbuktu's ancient manuscripts, which contain invaluable knowledge on various subjects, are being digitized and preserved to safeguard the cultural and intellectual achievements of the Songhai era. That was a brief description of the Songhai civilization. From me, Janet Ali, it's goodbye for now.
Well, and that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. It's always great having you. On behalf of the entire crew, it's me, Mubarak Kenya, saying goodbye for now.
Around great suffering within, this is the love has tied me in place. took my heart and made fond of it, desired to kill. Come and see what love has done to me. Come and see what love has done to me. Got me deeply involved in despair. Come and see what love has done to me. Come and see what love has done to me. Got me deeply involved in despair. Now and then, like the winds I blew. Now and then, like the roads I grew. Now and then, like the floods I flow. I'm Yunus, mystic of sorrow, suffering wounds from top to toe. In the hands of beloved, I write in woe. Come and see what love has done to me. Come and see what love has done to me. Got me deeply involved in this pain.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaam alaikum. This is Hussein, and you're listening to your program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we talk about different Islamic teachings and Quranic elements pertaining to humanity and human beings. And in previous episodes, we started studying and covering a very good book in this regard titled A 250-Year-Old Person, which is a compilation of the sermons and lectures delivered by His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. In these sermons and lectures, he covers the life story and seerah, or biographies, of the Prophet of Islam sallallahu alaihi wasallam and the great leaders of Islam from his pure progeny. We were talking about the life of the Prophet of Islam in Medina. We talked about the external threats to early Muslim community in Medina. We talked about the pagans of Quraysh who attacked Muslims in Badr. And then we talked about how that resulted in another subsequent attack by pagans against Muslims in Uhud. There is this mountain called Uhud in the north of Medina. And pagans encountered, the army of pagans encountered army of Muslims there after an initial defeat of pagans against Muslims. Unfortunately, because of the disobedience of some of the Muslims, and because Quran says وَفَشَلْتُمْ, you lost your courage and you left your positions, and that's why the enemy took advantage and attacked Muslims from the behind. And in that situation, chaotic situation, many good Muslims were martyred, including Hamza, the uncle of the Prophet of Islam, and some of those members of the army of Muslims, they were running away, escaping the battlefield. Quran says, "It's that tasaduna wa la talwuna ala ahadin." You were climbing the mountain, and you would not even turn to see behind what's going on in the battlefield. And the Prophet was alone, except for some Muslims who remained and defended the Prophet. So it was a bad story and bad memory for Muslims, especially the martyrdom of Hamza affected the Prophet gravely, and also other Muslims who were martyred. And there was a lesson for Muslims to be taken from this, that if you disobey the leadership, if you do not abide by the laws or by the instructions given by the leader, unfortunately, defeats such as what we see in Uhud are very possible. Then, after Uhud, because of that situation, you could say that the pagans still had hope that we can have our final blow to this community, to this religion, but we need proper preparation. So you have the Battle of Confederates, or Ahzab, or Khandaq, the Battle of Trench. And the reason that is called the Battle of Trench is that in the fifth year after the migration, pagans, being very happy from the results of Uhud, they said, okay, now we should just go and finish these people. But for this, we need to take other tribes beside ourselves. Now, in this book, in his lecture, Ayatollah Khamenei says that people of Quraysh might not have been very expert in military techniques and tactics. That's why, because they were mainly good in business. And that's why they took aid from other tribes, and they create alliance against Muslims. That's why it's called confederates, Ahzab. So they created a very big army, and they wanted to attack Muslims by surprise. But Muslims were informed beforehand, and they took in defensive position. Inshallah, we're going to cover that in the second segment after the break.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin al-Mustafa. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin al-Mustafa.
Welcome back. This is Hussein, and you're listening to your program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. We were talking about the Battle of the Trench. We said it is called the Battle of the Trench because of the defense measure that Muslims took upon the instruction or suggestion by Salman the Persian, Salman Farsi, when the Prophet and the Muslim community in Medina were informed about the preparation of a great army by confederates who were coming towards Medina. And they had only 1 week to think how they want to encounter them. The numbers were very higher than Muslims. And they had in mind, the confederates, the pagans of Mecca, they had in mind that we go to Medina, we kill 100, 200 people, including the leadership and the people who are close to Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and then Islam will be finished. So Muslims were informed of this, and the Prophet summoned a council of Muslims that what should we do? And Salman suggested that in situations like this, in our part, in Persia, we have a defense measure. We call it Khandaq, which is coming from the root, old Persian root, Khandaq, which means something that you dig. So we dig trench, like large trench and long trenches, that would stop the army from coming to our city. So Muslims started And again, you have the leadership style of the prophet, come and come, not go and go. The prophet himself started digging the trench, and all other Muslims also participated in that. Ahead of everyone was the prophet himself, who would spend times here and there helping Muslims and digging the trench. So after 1 week, they had a long trench dug around Medina. Actually, there are some natural barriers like the rocks and hilltops around Medina that would function as natural barriers, and Muslims did not have to dig trench there. They only had one space in the north of Medina that they had to dig a trench. And then when the Confederate army arrived there, and it was winter, actually, so they were stopped. They could not do anything. And they spent, I think, 2 weeks there, including a week of digging the trench. It lasted for Muslims for 3 weeks. After 2 weeks being there, the Confederate army could not do anything, and they went back. That is the short version of the story. And there the prophet said that this was the last time that they tried to attack us. And from now on, this will be our time to take active steps, not in the form of offensive attacks, but active steps. Inshallah, we're going to cover them in the next episode, how the prophet, step by step, started to get close and establish their ground further and further by having the Umrah al-Qadha and then the Fatah, the triumphant return to Mecca without any bloodshed and in a peaceful way. Thank you very much for listening. Inshallah, next episode we're going to cover those later years of the life of the Prophet in Medina and leading to the Fatah, triumphant return to Mecca. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Jannah, it's all I ever wish for. This life is not eternal, but the next will last forever.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
Amma اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The recent launch of a Muslim association aspiring to be registered as a political party has caused an uproar in Italy. The association, named MURO 27, the acronym for Muslims for Rome, aims to participate in the 2027 mayoral elections in the Italian capital, Rome. Following the announcement of the new association, several Italian media close to Italy's ruling right coalition and some anti-immigrant League party members have slammed the initiative as a threat to Italy's liberal institutions, a project that, quote, aims to plant the crescent flag on Rome's Capitol Hill.
This initiative has been immediately exploited by some anti-immigrant, anti-Islam parties for political gain. Having said that, the initiators of this association should have involved the whole of the Muslim community.
I am of the idea that such initiatives are welcomed when they are in the public interest. Many Italians are very wary of traditional politics, but I am afraid they are not ready to support a Muslim candidate, as recently happened in New York.
The MURO 27 Association has been funded by a group of Muslims led by Francesco Thieri, an Italian engineer who converted to Islam about 20 years ago when he added to his name that of Abd al-Haq, one of the names of God in the Quran. Thieri already ran as a candidate in Rome's 2021 local elections. The Italian capital is home to about 120,000 Muslims, 40,000 of whom are Italian citizens. Islam is not formally recognized as a religion in Italy, despite 1.5 million Muslims live in the country. Furthermore, the organizations representing Muslims are also not legally recognized by the Italian state, albeit Muslims have the constitutional right to practice their religion.
To this day, the issue of the Muslims in Italy has been solely tackled with security policies, overlooking the political, social, and cultural dimensions of our religion. As for the new association, it's not clear yet, in my view, what the nature and the goals of this initiative are.
Strangely enough, Italy already has a Muslim mayor, but no controversy has been raised about his election. It is Moreno Marzetti, an Italian convert who also is a member of the anti-Islam, anti-immigrant League party. He was elected as mayor of Italy's northern town of Malo in 2020. Max Civili, Press TV, Rome.
A new report submitted to the United States Congress has reignited debate over China's rising defense capabilities. Citing Pakistan's battlefield performance during the May conflict, the assessment notes Islamabad's effective use of Chinese-supplied weaponry. The congressional report highlights that the systems sourced from China played a decisive role in Pakistan's recent military success, pointing to Beijing's steadily advancing defense industry. The findings are seen by analysts as a sign that Chinese platforms, long dismissed in Washington as second tier, are now demonstrating reliability and precision in real conflict scenarios. Islamabad's expanding partnership with Beijing through joint exercises and coordinated training reinforces this shift.
Without a doubt, China has surprised the world. However, China's weapons and technology are not yet tested.
China has not been involved in as many wars as the USA. So their technology will be new and surprising, but we cannot say for certain they can outclass U.S. technology.
These trends come at a moment when the United States is expanding its own deployments in South Korea and Japan and intensifying patrols in the South China Sea. Regional observers say the growing China-Pakistan alignment is complicating Washington's broader strategy to contain Beijing's military rise. For Pakistan, the cooperation offers technological upgrades and strategic diversification, while for China, it signals greater influence across South and West Asia.
China is an emerging superpower, whether it is in terms of their economy or the speed of their jets. Their recent military parade shocked the world. President Xi Jinping was there too. They have changed the power dynamics of the region and definitely the world too.
From Islamabad's perspective, the message is straightforward. China's defense edge is becoming harder for Washington to ignore. And Pakistan's cooperation with Beijing is now part of that shifting balance. Anna Muhyiddin, Islamabad.
Wahdat Hall served as the venue for Iran's National Heroes Day. The event brought together people, including families of martyrs, officials and writers, to honor their heroes and reminisce about their legacy.
The key component of our strength lies in the role of families and women. Their support for the fighters ultimately contributes to hero-making and to the transmission of a culture of resistance to future generations.
Across Iran, people find heroism in those who gave their lives for the Islamic Revolution, the 8-year sacred defense, the nation's nuclear and missile programs, the fight against US-backed Daesh, and the 12-day defense against the US and the Zionist regime, offering the world a different definition of a hero.
The works produced in the literature of the sacred defense are of an enlightening and motivating nature, which is the same quality that contributed to the early spread of Islam.
The program was further enriched by the unveiling of three commendations written by the leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on the lives of three martyrs.
The book Endless Fever not only recounts the life of a paraplegic veteran, but also portrays the way a family confronts and copes with this situation.
It was God's will that I became the mother of a martyr, and I must express my gratitude to all mothers of martyrs for raising such children.
The young companions of Martyr Soleimani, who sacrificed themselves to fight terrorism and imperialist schemes, perhaps serve as the strongest proof that the future generations of Iran will continue the path of resistance.
The National Heroes Day is named for the day when Martyr Soleimani's letter to Ayatollah Khamenei marked the annihilation of Daesh. 8 years later, Iranians continue to resist oppression, whether through literature or on the battlefield. Moin Amini, Tehran.
The scale of military spending across the 27-member European Union is staggering. On Wednesday, the bloc's executive arm, the European Commission, unveiled a new wave of major defense initiatives.
During the next 10 years, there will be around 6.8 trillion euros spent by member states for defense.
At the same time, more than 93 million EU citizens remain at risk of poverty, roughly 21% of the population. We put these figures to officials at Wednesday's defense briefing.
How do we justify this huge amount of money that we're spending in terms of military?
Of course, every government needs to spend on education, social affairs, everything. You know, the needs are enormous. The trouble is that, you know, if you have, you know, infrastructure attacked, if you have, you know, schools and hospitals attacked like they are right now in Ukraine, all of this doesn't matter if you're not able to defend what you have.
Since 2022, the EU has directed 177 billion euro toward Ukraine, much of it supporting Kiev's military effort. We asked members of the public for their views on military spending versus social investment.
The public support is not there, so I do think we need to strike a better balance and listen a bit better to the population.
It doesn't help either when you mentioned about this corruption, the latest corruption scandal in Ukraine. It kind of
that sways public opinion as well. No, for sure. I think that's people start asking questions, and rightly so.
It is very important to focus on the social crisis we're in right now. And so many people are not, like, they don't have their rights looked after. And that is should be a primary concern.
If you don't have defense capabilities and if you don't have deterrence, then you cannot really expect to cover all the any of the other aspects either, because if you don't have the basic safety in the society, then everything else falls wayside as well.
As the Commission pushes ahead with its plans for record military spending, the political risk is unmistakable. Many analysts say if citizens judge their leaders are prioritising arms manufacturers over the basic needs of ordinary people, it will certainly fuel a rise in anti-EU sentiment, the kind that will not only threaten this strategy, but the very future of the bloc itself. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Israeli violations against Lebanon have intensified, with IOF targeting different villages across South Lebanon, striking multiple buildings. This direct assault on residential areas follows an Israeli drone strike on a vehicle in the town of At-Tiri, killing one person and injuring 11. Earlier, the Ain al-Halwi Palestinian refugee camp near Saidun witnessed a massacre. An Israeli strike hit a mini football stadium, claiming the lives of at least 14 people.
It is a message of intimidation to our Palestinian people in the Palestinian camps meant to produce political outcomes. It is one of many forms of pressure that our Palestinian people are being subjected to.
This ongoing bloodshed, driven by relentless assaults, signifies a dangerous escalation in the regime's unyielding campaign against the Arab nation. Hezbollah condemned the massacre at Ain al-Halwi as a blatant violation of Lebanon's sovereignty. The Lebanese resistance cautioned that any tolerance or weak response would only embolden the enemy, calling for a strong and unified approach to confront and deter the aggression. Hezbollah's Secretary General, Sheikh Naim Qasem, has said what Lebanon faces is not a failure to implement the ceasefire, but an aggression.
The events occurring today in Lebanon do not represent a mere failure to implement a ceasefire agreement. Instead, they signify a blatant act of aggression aimed at seizing control of Lebanon and stripping it of all forms of strength, military, economic, and political. Their objective is to take control of Lebanon.
Sheikh Qasem directly addressed the government, urging it to reject external pressures, and highlighted that this is a time of steadfastness. According to the United Nations Interim Force in Lebanon, the Israeli regime has committed over 7,300 violations of Lebanese airspace and conducted 2,400 military operations inside Lebanon since the start of ceasefire in last November. In the face of an enemy that apparently understands only the language of force, a harsh truth becomes evident throughout Lebanon. The arms in the hands of Hezbollah are no longer a matter of political debate. They now represent the country's ultimate and singular deterrent against the Israeli aspirations.
For months, Tulkarem's neighborhoods have been bulldozed, sealed, and emptied during repeated Israeli raids that have turned entire residential blocks into rubble. As the world remains silent, hundreds of displaced families say they have been left to endure their trauma alone, living between relatives' homes, UN shelters, or temporary structures with no certainty of what comes next.
Nur Sham's camp has suffered greatly, and it continues to suffer. The camp has been emptied of all forms of life. We are expressing our rejection of this enemy's policies. This is a stance of refusal, not a plea for mercy from the occupier.
As Duja speaks, her voice steady but heavy with exhaustion, the sound of live fire cracks through the air above us, a stark reminder that even simple interview unfolds under danger.
As much as we are filled with pain over the camp's condition, we are equally proud of it. We are steadfast. If we were not causing the enemy pain, it wouldn't commit all this brutality against us.
New Shams residents say that the same brutality crushing Gaza is echoed here in the West Bank, where nearly a year of displacement have pushed families into tents and overcrowded apartments. Yet even under fire, they remain strong, insisting the world must not ignore their struggle.
Today, as you saw, we came for a peaceful stand, completely harmless. Yet the Israeli military opened fire. We pose no threat. Our situation is catastrophic. We are dying outside our camps and homes. Some people are living in mountains, tents, or paying extremely high rents. We want to return to our homes. Even if only one room remains, we want to go back.
For the people of Nur Shams, return is not a political slogan. It is a survival. After nearly a year of forced expulsion, their message remains the same. They will endure the danger, but refuse to surrender the place they call home. Standing here among the crowds in Nur Shams, you feel the exhaustion, but also the determination. Families who have lost everything are gathered shoulder to shoulder, insisting on a simple right to return to their homes they were forced to leave. Naqa Hamid, Tul Kerem, Occupied West Bank.
In May and June of this year, Israeli actress Gal Gadot was in the British capital London to film her latest Hollywood movie. Seven pro-Palestine activists caught wind of the location of the film shoot and proceeded to loudly protest outside the site on numerous days, successfully disrupting the filming and imposing large costs on the production of the movie. Gadot, a former member of the Israeli military who took part in the 2006 aggression against Lebanon, is now a Hollywood actress using her platform to advance pro-genocide propaganda on behalf of the regime.
The seven activists were summoned to Westminster Magistrates Court last month. They faced charges of harassment and wrongfully and unlawfully obstructing access to a workplace after pressure was exerted on authorities by pro-Israel lobbyists in the UK. But on the eve of a major hearing on Tuesday, the accused had all charges dropped, with security forces saying that they would receive no further action.
The outcome represents a major victory for the activists, dubbed the Gal Gadot Seven, who in recent months have been facing heavy pressure from the British state, which critics say is acting on behalf of the Zionist lobby in the UK.
I think it's really important to stand up to these Zionist intimidation tactics to show them that A, it won't work, and B, you know, we always have to remember what we're doing this for. You know, we're doing this for the Palestinians, and, you know, it's a very small ask of me, for example, to forfeit 5% of my privilege so that a whole people don't have to lose everything.
The initial court hearing was adjourned due to Jewish extremists attempting to sit in the court's public gallery in order to learn of the activists' home addresses. Sadly for the extremists, they've been deprived yet again of an opportunity to gain key intelligence that would enable them to step up the campaign of intimidation against pro-Palestinian organizers that they're waging in collaboration with the British state.
They're doing this to discourage us, to showcase where they're failing as a state in Britain and across the world, because we are showcasing their flaws, and what we are doing is only right because we are showcasing the truth, because you can't hide it forever.
Critics have pointed to Gadot's wooden performances on the big screen, raising questions about nepotism and whether she's only been given high-profile acting roles in order to promote propaganda on behalf of the genocidal Israeli regime. In this case, the activists not only disrupted the film shoot, but also successfully beat the trumped-up criminal charges they were faced with. Issa Kadhimi, London.
Allah, 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 Allah.